So, good morning. Today, we will end this morning program with Fusatsu ceremony by reciting the 16 Bodhisattva precepts together, chanting together, and then offering prostrations. Fusatsu. So the word Fusatsu comes from the Sanskrit word posada, which means to fast, to purge the body of harmful toxins that have accumulated as a result of consuming unwholesome foods. And like the body, the mind can also be intoxicated by an accumulation of harmful impurities through unobserved thinking, unwholesome words, and actions. So in the context of our practice, the word Fusatsu has two important meanings. First is to nurture the mind with wholesome nourishment, and second, to deprive the mind of unwholesome nourishment. And developing the ability to discern between what is wholesome and what is unwholesome happens over time through deepening the level of awareness, developing a tenacious stance, and a gentle cultivation of discipline, continuous cultivation of discipline. A Fusatsu ceremony is a traditional way to reignite this vital endeavor and remind ourselves to keep the finger on the pulse, so to speak, and be aware of our thoughts, words, and actions all the time. Not in a tense way, but more in a continuous, tenacious way. And traditionally, this event is held on some regular basis for the purpose of raising the intention to live our lives with integrity and morality in accordance with the Buddha Dharma. Sila Paramita, the perfection of morality, is the second paramita which appears after the perfection of giving, Dana Paramita. And paramita means the practice of perfecting an ability, a trait, or an inherent potential we have. But it is also understood as a raft that ferries the practitioner from a deluded state of being to an awakened living. And so the intention of practicing and perfecting the six paramitas is to free us from the bondage created by our karma and lead us in a direction of living a life that is in alignment with our true nature. Being in alignment with who we are, in essence, naturally leads to living an authentic and wholesome life for the benefit of all. So the beginning of the Eightfold Path, right understanding or correct understanding, that's what this is about. The reference of deluded states of being means here that the falsehood of viewing ourselves as separate entities functioning independently from other beings and from our environment, which is what is meant by wrong view. This false sense of separation is the catalyst for much of our suffering and for our destructive behavior, as we see on a daily basis. So right or correct view means to view ourselves as interwoven through the grand fabric of the universe, in which everything affects everything. Everything, every little thought, every little nuanced activity or behavior, everything affects everything. It's very, very, very important to keep that in mind, because I think we forget that very quickly, and become self-centered again and again. It's quite clear that the way we lead our lives as human beings leave a trail of destruction and harm. And it is also clear that leading self-centered life based on accumulation and achievements ultimately does not deliver a deep sense of contentment and ease, and it causes much more harm than good. In fact, it often leads to a greater disappointment, since the hope that it will end the sense of dissatisfaction and unease gets crushed again and again. The question is, do we learn from our experiences individually and collectively? Do we study our lives? Do we study our own experiences? Doing what we have done, right? We have done a lot of different things, got to this point, looking back and examining, did it actually do what I thought it will do? Right? My resistance to different things that happen. My insistence that I am going to do what others were not able to do, meaning I'll find some sense of satisfaction from accumulating the right stuff, quote unquote, right stuff, or achieving certain things in life. In other words, does it work? Did it work? So do we learn? And do we also raise, after learning, deliberate intention? Deliberate intention, tenacity and courage to go against the grain of our harmful patterns and act differently. We often are caught up in cyclical, repetitive, kind of broken record way of being, way of living our lives, being irritated by the same stuff, reacting in the same way, and then retaliating in the same way. And then again and again and again and again. Even when we have moments of or periods of some recognition or realization, it seems as if we revert back to the same old way of being. Because it's familiar, because we find sense of security in that, because the alternative to knowing is not knowing, and that's always a big issue for us. So deliberate intention, but the way we understand the word intention here is very critical to the way we uphold the practice or any other endeavor we take on. The etymology of the word intention may be different, quite different than the common usage of it. The Latin origin of the word intendere, which translates as to stretch out, to lean forward, or to strain. It means to push ourselves beyond our comfort zone and venture out to unfamiliar territories, to stretch out, to be uncomfortable, be willing to be uncomfortable, to be willing to be uncomfortable. Nothing ever changes if we don't do that. The expectation that things will change without me doing something different or without me straining, stretching out beyond my comfort zone. That expectation has to be examined. How's it possible to grow? So often we say we want to grow, we want to deepen spiritually, but then there is a gap between that statement and our action, our thoughts, words, and actions. Something to examine. So to lean forward, to strain, it means to push ourselves beyond the comfort zone, venture out to unfamiliar territories. And so raising an intention is not just a passive, here is passive aspiration. It's not just, I am raising an intention. This is just empty words. So it means dynamic, action-oriented intensification of focused energy. Action, dynamic, focused energy. It has to mean something much more than just verbalizing. And it implies taking full responsibility for our thoughts, words, and actions, which are either at the service of harmful karma or at the service of wisdom and compassion. And all of it begins with our willingness to turn inwardly and face what we may want to run away from. Again, face what we may want to run away from. What we do run away from. It's probably more accurate. And there's a very strong connection, direct connection between our zazen practice and the practice of morality and compassionate action as it manifests through working with the precepts. So last Sunday, we concluded the fall session with a Jukai ceremony. And at the beginning, opening remarks of the ceremony, I spoke a little bit about disconnection. So I want to bring the words up again in relation to today's Fusatsu. What I said last Sunday is there is something very special about holding Jukai ceremony at the end of Sesshin. Since there is an intimate connection between our practice during Sesshin and the vow of a bodhisattva. As you know, during the days of Sesshin, we each take full responsibility to not escape the inner turmoil, the restlessness, and the pain we may experience, and deliberately work on quelling our harmful and impulsive energies. And so we can help each other to take this challenge. We also practice giving and receiving unconditional love and support at Sesshin. And then from within this womb, we take the bodhisattva vow. From within the depth, the womb of our practice, we emerge and take the bodhisattva vow. And a sesshin, right, all practice, like any other thing we do, is all voluntary, right? So there's a voluntary restriction. And one of the things that unite us as practitioners, one of the most important things that unite us as practitioners, is that willingness to go to where it's uncomfortable. If it's not for that, then this is just another game, one of many games we play as human beings. That's all it is, right? And so there is that underlying agreement that we all make with ourselves and each other that we are here to turn towards what we may want to run away from. And we are willing to work with it. We all are entangled in many ways. Who is more entangled or less entangled is completely irrelevant because we're not comparing. The only thing that's relevant is that we are here because we got to a point that we are fed up with ourselves. And I think it's very important for a practitioner that walks in the door to get to that point. I'm fed up with the way I am thinking, speaking, acting. There's got to be another way. Because I keep going around in circles, I keep creating a lot of harm, and I keep complaining about it. And it's very powerful, right, to realize that we are united by that, the depth of this full responsibility, taking full responsibility, not because somebody is telling us to do so, not because we are somehow, we gave our word to somebody or to an organization, and I need to honor my word, so fine, I'll do that. That's not going to last. So going forward in regards to Sesshin, just a note about that. If you do come to Sesshin, come with that willingness or don't come. Don't come because you're wasting your time. If you show up and you're not sure if you want to work with yourself, that's a big problem because at Sesshin, you will face yourself like that. It's not Sesshin. So we have to recognize that when we run away from Zazen or Sesshin or anything that has to do with practice, we are taking that which we found to be bothering us on the cushion, we are running down with it. There's no way to escape that. There is a way, there are many ways to numb ourselves, yes. Or many, many options to numb ourselves. Many options to escape facing. But we are never escaping. You can check out, but you can never leave, right? Check out. It's always with you. So this is the words of Chogyam Trungpa about our harmful tendency. I want to talk a little bit about that. You can please adjust as needed. Harmful action begins with a very small and minute shift of attention. And from that, things become enlarged and exaggerated. So this has to do with paying full attention moment by moment. Moment by moment, from the moment we wake up until the moment we go to sleep, paying full attention to every thought, every emotion, every word, every action, all the time. So what he's saying here, it begins with minute shift of attention, and from that things become enlarged and exaggerated. According to the Abhidharma, the connection between small ideas and large ideas is very, very important. For instance, sudden dramas, such as murdering somebody or creating immense chaos, begin on the level of minute concepts and tiny shifts of attention. Something large is being triggered by something quite small. The first little hint of dislike or attraction for somebody eventually escalates and brings on much more immense scale of emotional drama or psychodrama. So everything starts on a minute scale at the beginning and then expands. Things begin to swell and expand until they become very large, immeasurably large, in a lot of cases. We can experience that ourselves. Such minute shifts of attention are what create the emotion of aggression, passion, ignorance, and the rest. Although those emotions are seemingly very heavy-handed, large-scale, and crude, they have their origin in the subtle twist that takes place in our mind constantly. Very, very, very important. Because one tiny irritation, I don't like what he or she is doing. That is the origin of us as human beings killing each other. So we can complain about the chaos in the world and be blind to how we are engaged with the same stuff that creates it. It's the same stuff. How can something that somebody does, how can that destabilize you? Right? And it destabilizes you if you take one thought, and maybe that's a good point to remind everybody that phrase that meditation happens with the second thought. Right? It means it's not the first thought you have no control over. It just shows up in your mind. I hate this. I hate this. I hate him or her doing this or that. This is not something you decided to think about. It just showed up because you got triggered. Big deal. So what? You got triggered. If you start to string thoughts after that, now you think that thought and then you add another thought and then, yeah, I know she did it or he did it in the past. I don't like that. Blah, 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 blah. It goes on and on and on and on. And that's what he's talking about. That's what he's talking about. And imagine having a gun in the drawer, right? It escalates in the mind. And then all of a sudden, we feel justified to go and cause harm. We feel justified to hate, actually. What we do with it, well, there are many expressions of hatred, but we feel ultimately justified to discriminate and hate each other. It's very important to realize that it starts on a very tiny, minute level. One thought, one emotion, one wind direction change, whatever it is. And if we're not aware of that, it will escalate. We need to keep that in mind somehow. We need to go back to that. Because this is where our practice happens in real time. So, meditation, right? So, jhana, prajna, sila, right? So, it begins with jhana paramita, right? Zazen. And the practice of jhana gives rise to prajna. Why? Because we sit and we just observe. We just bear witness. Bearing witness, we get more and more comfortable being on that ground of wisdom that bears witness to everything, that does not judge, it does not judge, we do not judge. Because we merge with that, because we are that. So from that, from the core, the heart of our practice, we get in touch with wisdom, Prajna Paramita. And Prajna naturally manifests through Sila Paramita as we get up and move around. So upholding the precepts without having strong zazen practice is not going to work. It's not just not going to work. It actually can lead to more harm because we can become very self-centered and feel utterly justified because there is no wisdom behind that. So through zazen, we realize our original face. Through embracing the Dharma, we embody wisdom. And by maintaining the Sangha, we practice morality through upholding the precepts. It's all connected. It's one thing, right? The three treasures are one thing. Different manifestations, different expressions. And the practice of morality leads right back to meditation, which gives birth to wisdom. The first chapter in the Diamond Sutra illustrates this very clearly. If you remember, you may remember Subhuti seeing the Buddha going from the phenomenal to the noumenal, right? Turning to, as he said, the Buddha said, turning to that which was before me. Turning to that which was before me. To study the self is to forget the self. Right? That's what that means. So the Buddha went on his begging rounds, came back, sat down, ate his meal, washed his feet, put on his robe, folded his legs, and turned to that which was before him. So in the commentary to that, Sufa says, the Buddha puts on his robes and takes up his bowl to uphold the precepts of morality. He washes his feet and takes his seat to enter meditation. Thus does morality give birth to meditation, and meditation to wisdom. Also, by entering the city with his robes and bowl, and this is not the Buddha, this is us entering the city. Think of yourself going through Lincoln Tunnel into the city, if you walk in the city, or wherever you happen to be. It's the same exact thing. By entering the city with his robe and bowl, he goes from the noumenal, naked reality as it is, noumenal, into the phenomenal, everyday life. By washing his feet and taking his seat, he goes from the phenomenal into the noumenal. It is only by remaining unattached to the noumenal as well as the phenomenal, undifferentiated prajna can be realized. So again and again and again, that's cyclical practice, right, that we maintain. Turning the attention towards nothing and then turning the attention back to something again and again and again and again until there's no more difference between this and that because prajna does not do that, right? So that's why it says here, undifferentiated prajna. Prajna is there underlying everything. We can ignore it, as we do, or we can turn towards it. And turning towards it, of course, becomes more challenging when we leave our cushion. Right? It's easy. It becomes easier, as challenging as zazen may be. It becomes easier to get in touch with that on the cushion because there's nobody there to bug you or trigger you. Right? So that's why people often say a week or two after or a day after Sesshin, this was incredible. Now I am triggered again. What do I do? What do I do? And the answer to that is keep practicing. Keep practicing. What, you expected that this will be it? Magic wand, one Sesshin? Doesn't work this way. Not because it doesn't work. It doesn't work this way because we are heavily vested in ourselves. So we have to give it time. Right? So we go again and again to Sesshin, to a Zazen Kai. Every day we turn inwardly and we see Zazen. And we practice. And we pay attention. And paying attention is not just a phrase. If we don't pay attention to that, we are paying attention to something else. If we don't pay attention to what is wholesome, we are paying attention to what is unwholesome. And then we are not depriving, we are actually nurturing unwholesome. One second thought is already nurturing unwholesome karma. So this is our daily practice. This is how we maintain. From the phenomenal, we dive into zazen, experience the noumenal through samadhi, and then enter the phenomenal again and again and again. So then the absolute and the relative are no longer seen as two. Now, taking refuge, so I want to go back to the words of Reb Anderson from Being Upright about the three treasures, taking refuge in the three treasures. He wrote, "When I take refuge in Buddha, I don't take refuge in my good points or my skillful behavior, and of course, I don't take refuge in my shortcomings. I take refuge in me being me. That is my indestructible virtue, which is never lost except for me forgetting it or not facing up to it." Which is what happens when our attention drifts. To take refuge means to give up running away from home. Give up running away from who we are. Give up running away. Give up looking for all kinds of ways to numb ourselves or displacement activities. It means to recognize my responsibility to live in accordance with my Buddhahood. When you take refuge in Buddha, when you go back to being fully yourself, you begin to see how you are connected to and depend on everybody. That's how you, by turning inwardly, you realize that in origin, we are one with all things. It's not a cliche, it's real. And how everybody depends on you. In other words, the first refuge really contains the other two. When you take refuge in Buddha, you begin to understand the teaching of interdependence, which is taking refuge in Dharma. And you honor your connection with other beings, which is taking refuge in Sangha. In fact, the practice of taking refuge in Buddha opens your eyes to all the other precepts: not killing, not stealing, right conduct, and working to help other beings. All these come from the condition of you being you, atadipa, right? The condition of you being you is the source of peace and the source of love. In essence, to take refuge is to give up all alternatives to being a Buddha. Give up all alternatives to being a Buddha. To being yourself. When you see and accept that you have no such alternatives, you naturally and spontaneously go forward on the path of Buddha. When you're willing to throw yourself completely into your everyday life, moment by moment, you are taking refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. It's one thing. And it's the way to unity. It's the way to experience unity and manifest unity. And you know, I thought about this. It's interesting how you probably follow what's happening in Israel. And because of this war, the Israeli government decided to form an emergency unified government. And it's amazing because they were so hateful until that point. And now, okay, well, we're attacked. Okay, we're going to put aside all those hateful thoughts and behavior, and now we can come together and we can operate together. And it's crazy because do we need to be threatened to realize that we can actually work together? It's insane how we are as human beings. We need to have a collective threat, or a threat that is collectively threatening everybody. Fine, if we need that, then what about climate change? Isn't that enough? Why are we not uniting, seeing that climate change doesn't care about our thoughts, about our opinions? And the amazing thing about that, when this war is going to end, they're all going to go back to their corners and fight again. Isn't that a game? Let's agree to stop the game, because now we're dealing with real life situation. When this ends, now we can pretend again and play and hate each other. And I think that's a teaching, or should be a teaching for us. Anyway, so for Satsu, what we're going to do, we're going to open with the five remembrances, the four immeasurables. Then we're all going to stand up. Those of us who are ordained will open up our zagus. We will recite, so Myogen will say the precept and we will all repeat. Okay? We'll recite the precepts. And then we will make three full bows to close. And then we will sit down and seal it with the Kalaniya Metta Sutra.